difficult.
The unrest also sparked hostilities between Gaza-based Palestinian resistance fighters and Israeli regime forces as the two sides exchanged fire early on Thursday. The lack of mainstream media attention, despite the shocking footage which has emerged, has equally infuriated many onlookers.
It's not just me. Every Palestinian have been hit with the fact that international law is very selective. The application of international law depends on the interests of these countries. And, you know, the major powers insist to keep putting Israel above the law, to keep shielding Israel from international scrutiny and international sanctions. And if this does anything, it actually exposes that the world is not serious about its own rules and laws.
This isn't the first time that the Israeli regime has conducted acts of aggression against Muslims during the holy month of Ramadan in occupied Palestine. However, global awareness of Israel's crimes is at an all-time high, and with future protest action planned over the next days and weeks here in London, the global reaction to what's been going on is far from over. Robert Carter, London.
Whispers with God on a night that's believed by Muslims to be a time when their wishes are fulfilled. It's called Laylatul Qadr, or the Night of Destiny. Muslims observe the occasion every year in the month of Ramadan, when they congregate at religious sites to pray and make wishes. To Iranians, no place is better than the shrine of the 8th Shia Imam Reza in the city of Mashhad to keep vigil on the occasion.
Words cannot describe my feelings tonight. It's a night of destiny when God has promised to listen to our prayers. It's a night which the Quran says is better than 1,000 months. I'm so happy to be in Imam Reza's shrine on this divine night.
After 2 years, we once again can visit the holy shrine of Imam Reza, our beloved Imam, and that on the night of destiny. I wish that God will eradicate the coronavirus once and for all, for us to be able to live peacefully and visit our holy sites.
Islamic scriptures say Laylatul Qadr marks the night when the Quran was revealed to Prophet Muhammad. The Quran says on this night, angels descend on earth to listen to the prayers of worshippers.
We believe that on the night of destiny, angels come to earth upon God's order. The Quran says in its verses that the book was revealed to the Prophet on this night, and the angels will stay on earth till dawn. That's why we never miss out on this holy night and come here to pray.
No exact date is provided for the Night of Destiny, but all Islamic references are unanimous that the Quran was revealed to the Prophet on one of three different dates, the 19th, the 21st, or the 23rd night of the holy month of Ramadan.
It's the first time after more than 2 years that the Night of Destiny is marked without serious concerns over the coronavirus, and this has attracted this huge number of pilgrims to the shrine of Imam Reza to once again mark Laylatul Qadr en masse, and at the same time, reunite with their 8th Imam after 2 years. Yusuf Jalali from the Holy Shrine of Imam Reza in Mashhad.
Violence, oppression, and desecration of holy sites. Just more of the Ramadan reminders that Palestinians continue to live under occupation and suffer daily injustices. More than ever, international solidarity, especially in an age of social media, is important, with the atrocities being committed against Palestinians, raising awareness and exhibiting support is more crucial than before. This year's Fly the Flag for Palestine campaign is giving millions across the world the opportunity to show solidarity by displaying a Palestinian flag in person or online.
If we are not able to stand up at this hour of need and be supportive those Palestinians by holding a flag on our car, on our shops, on our homes, then what are we good for? And when are we going to do this? And I think what I have seen, ordinary people responding so fantastically.
In the lead up to the annual Al-Quds rally in the British capital, the global support for the campaign is in full swing. Organizers are encouraging participation in this year's event, and taking part could not be more simple. First of all, please post your image or your footage online, encourage a few friends to do the same, and of course, use the hashtag. As the global solidarity movement grows, so does the opposition, a fact not lost on pro-Palestine campaigners.
We got ministers coming and saying, you know, they're going to refer us to the police for saying from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. It's outrageous. These are the same people that actually articulate that freedom of speech is absolute, and you know they go on and on. What's wrong with any part of the world to be free? What's wrong with asking people to be free?
So organizers are urging you to do your part. Lift your voice in solidarity and fly the flag for Palestine. Amina Taylor, London.
Yemen Civil Aviation and Meteorology Authority announced that the first commercial flight to Sana'a International Airport will start next Sunday from Anto, Jordan. Observers say the UN brokered agreement said there will be two flights a week from and to Egypt and Jordan, and allowing one flight only is not enough to help the humanitarian situation.
Announcing the start of one flight per week to Jordan is not enough and confirms there are no sincere intentions by the Saudi-led coalition to abide by the declared UN truce. There must be a full opening of Sana'a Airport and the port of Hodeidah because the humanitarian situation cannot tolerate more restrictions.
The Ministry of Health says thousands of patients, including children, are in dire need to travel abroad for treatment. Therefore, the United Nations should fulfill its duty and remove any restrictions on the two weekly flights.
Yemeni patients suffer greatly due to the closure of Sana'a's international airport because they need to travel abroad for treatment. There are 30,000 registered patients in the higher medical committee, including children suffering from congenital anomalies and cancer. We demand the United Nations and the UN envoy open Sana'a's airport permanently and not for one or two flights per week, as it's not enough to help the humanitarian situation.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen on March 2015 and imposed a closure on Sana'a International Airport. This closure has led to the death of thousands of patients, including children, especially amid the collapse of the healthcare system in the country due to the years-long Saudi war and the blockade.
Yemenis received the news of resuming the flights of Sana'a International Airport with hopes to see further flights to other destinations around the world. They say opening Sana'a Airport will save the lives of thousands of Yemeni patients, including children, who are in danger amid the absence of essential healthcare services. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
For the first time since the onset of the COVID pandemic, hundreds of people of faith and none gathered in the shadow of North London's Finsbury Park Mosque to enjoy a breaking of the fast in a public setting. The iftar, backed by the local council and organized by Finsbury Park Mosque, Muslim Welfare House and British Muslim charity Islamic Relief, was an opportunity for the community to gather, celebrate and reflect.
It's good to show solidarity, Muslim, non-Muslim, Jews, Christian, all coming together to share a meal. This is a very powerful message that we are united, we are all at one despite our differences.
It's important because it's a very visible sign of the friendship and, you know, the togetherness that we have all through the year, actually. But and it's such lovely hospitality.
For me, it's an opportunity to, I suppose, show solidarity with my Muslim sisters and also, as Pauline said, take part in this wonderful experience.
It's no coincidence that this gathering is taking place during Ramadan, one of the most revered periods in the Islamic calendar, a time not just for abstention and reflection, but to help those who are less fortunate.
Ramadan is a time when we're always thinking about our friends, our family, our neighbours, our community at large. And I think it's one of those moments when we can all gather together, especially after the last couple of years when we haven't been able to do that.
The Street Iftar Party was first organised in June 2017, just days after the terror attack in the Finsbury Park area on Muslim worshippers during the month of Ramadan that cost one man his life and injured nine others. The public iftar was a way for communities to show solidarity and silence hatred with hope.
Tonight, we celebrate. We celebrate the achievements of the Muslim community in this area. We celebrate and thank them for all that they do, and we enjoy a wonderful iftar supper.
This is in memory of our beloved brother Makram Ali, who lost his life in this incident, unfortunately. And we are here. We want to have it every year to... And, you know, remember what's happened and try to bring communities together after what's happened. And this is the main idea, is to bring us together, to say to those who try to divide us and spread hatred, fear and division that you will not succeed. We are together and we will be always together. Islamophobia has no place in our society, and we should all fight it.
At a time of global disunity, one small corner of North London is showing there is another way. Amina Taylor, London.
The Journalists Union in Damascus organized a ceremony to pay tribute to journalists who were killed in battlefields while reporting on the years-long war on Syria. Officials attending the ceremony praised the sacrifices of those journalists, who included reporters, cameramen, and employees of media outlets.
Syrian journalists had double the responsibility. They faced a ferocious war waged by huge media outlets on Syria. Journalists wrote their words in blood in respect of their job, homeland, and principles. We remain loyal to the blood of our martyrs.
It was unfortunately a long list of those who were killed, but a reminder of the sacrifices made for the sake of defending Syria. Families and relatives received certificates of appreciation, including one for Press TV correspondent Maya Nasser, who I proudly received it on behalf of his family.
This ceremony means a lot. It means that the martyrs are always remembered in the media outlets they work for. They sacrifice their lives for the sake of the country. We are proud of their sacrifices.
We used to miss him a lot, even when he was alive. He worked most of the time. After leaving for work for a whole month, we saw him once, and then he was killed. It's a nice gesture to honor him by the Journalists' Union.
Maya Nasser was killed by terrorists in 2012 while covering an attack on the Ministry of Defense in the Syrian capital. He was one of many journalists who was keen on being on front lines to deliver the truth and perform his duty. In Syria, tens of journalists fearlessly risked their lives, were injured or killed just to convey the truth amid a ferocious mainstream media campaign to distort the reality. Honoring those journalists underlines the crucial role the media plays in any war, especially nowadays. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The French presidential election is being described as a populist bloc of Marine Le Pen versus an elitist bloc of Emmanuel Macron, but many don't seem to want to join either group. The first round's third place finisher held an internal poll. Almost 70% of his leftist supporters will either abstain or submit blank ballots rather than vote for either candidate. France's Muslims don't see a choice which isn't Islamophobic. Macron continues to support bashing Islamo-leftism, while Le Pen has an on-again, off-again plan to give fines for wearing the hijab in public. The student class isn't taking sides either. They recently blocked universities over what they say are two bad candidates.
The elder class may provide the key vote. Back when he expected an easy victory, Macron promised to raise the retirement age to 65. Now he's backtracking in an effort to win over left-wing voters, but many aren't sure what his true plans really are.
Le bilan d'Emmanuel Macron n'est pas forcément positif.
Macron's record isn't very positive. Long-term unemployment, economic instability, the destabilizing effects of the yellow vests. People have many different reasons for being disappointed with him.
In 2017, the two mainstream parties were swept out of power, But the repeat second-round matchup has many voters upset that new ideas remain absent.
La ligne conservatrice réactionnaire.
The conservative and reactionary line is championed by Le Pen, but she's very divisive. Many of her electorate preferred Eric Zemmour in the first round, and then there are many mainstream conservatives who will never vote for her or the national rally. The key traits of this vote are bitter abstention and bored indecisiveness.
Most polls show Macron leading by around 6 to 8 points, but that's within the margin of error, and Western polls have consistently undercounted the right nationalist candidate. The runoff is on April 24th. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
There are many security experts who claim the expansion of NATO in recent years close to Russia's borders and provocative military exercises are factors that brought about the conflict in Ukraine. Now EU members Finland and Sweden are poised to announce they want to join NATO. One analyst has been giving us his reaction via broadband.
That's a very serious escalation toward Russia, because this is when the United States will put nuclear bombs in Finland, and that would mean a direct escalation that Russia will not accept.
Finland shares a border with Russia that is more than 1,300 kilometres long. Moscow points out that if this country was to join the 30-nation alliance, NATO's land border with the Russian Federation would more than double in length. A new opinion poll by Le Soir newspaper has found that 90% of citizens surveyed in Belgium said the war worries them, but that they do not support direct military intervention over concerns that it could trigger a new world war. A quarter of those questioned said the West's supply of weapons to fighters in Ukraine is, quote, a bad thing. We have also been asking members of the public about this.
Yeah, I think we should stop doing that, huh? Because, war... fights war and then ends up in more war. So it's more about like discussing, talking.
It's a very good thing to have a dialogue with Russians and hopefully sort this out without war.
Ideally, diplomacy is the way that this comes to an end, but it takes two sides. From what I'm reading, they don't want to negotiate at all yet.
On Tuesday, the European Commission defended the decisions taken by EU governments to send arms to Ukraine.
In this case, more weapons doesn't mean more war. More weapons for Ukraine means more ability for the Ukrainian army to defend its people.
As concerns over possible escalation continue to increase, Finland and Sweden are expected to announce, before the end of this month, if they intend to join NATO. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. When the far-right French politician Marine Le Pen posed for a selfie with a smiling teenager in a Muslim headscarf in Dunkirk on the northern coast of France, it was a turning point in the French presidential campaign. Marine Le Pen wants to ban the Muslim headscarf from all public places, including the streets of France, calling it a uniform of totalitarian ideology. So after posing happily with a Muslim girl in a hijab, she was attacked for going soft by her far-right rival, the television pundit Eric Zemmour. Let me teach you about humanity, Marine Le Pen shot back at one of Zemmour's lieutenants in a television debate that went viral. What would you have done? Pulled her veil off and mistreated her? The news analysis you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Angelique Chrysaphis. The piece is titled How Le Pen Tried to Soften Image to Reach French Election Runoff. One analyst called Marine Le Pen's tactic of appearing softer in person than her policy proposals a masterclass. She also sought to present herself as less dangerous than Eric Zemmour's extremist newcomers on France's tense and fractured political scene. It was mid-March. Her poll ratings took off and kept rising. Marine Le Pen, a 53-year-old, who has been a member of the parliament for 5 years, has created a distance between her smiling persona, posing with her pet Bengal cats for being mobbed by teenagers for selfies in the street, and the radical reality of her far-right anti-immigration manifesto, To Keep France for the French. She has promised a referendum to change the constitution in order to curb the rights of immigrants and foreigners. She aims to prioritise natives over non-natives for housing, benefit jobs and healthcare. She would scrap nationality rights for children born and raised in France by foreign parents. Her success in reaching the runoff against Emmanuel Macron on Sunday, 24th of April, is not just about her long-running drive to sanitise her party's image and move it away from the jackbooted and anti-Semitic imagery of the past. That Marine Le Pen is now closer to power than ever before is in part the result of her own rethink of political strategy. Le Pen's analysis of Emmanuel Macron's 5 years in power, which have included the Gilets Jaunes or the Yellow Vests anti-government protests, was that Emmanuel Macron was a polarizing figure who had angered and divided the country and was out of touch with people's everyday concerns. Unlike her two previous populist presidential campaigns, in which she furiously sought to harness people's anger, this time she decided voters were exhausted by years of demonstrations and wanted calm. She positioned Macron as the divisive one, and herself as someone who could unite. Instead of holding big rallies, Marine Le Pen went under the radar to visit markets in small towns and villages, listening and posing for selfies. Instead of pushing her anti-immigration platform, which remains just as radical as before, she focused on the cost of living crisis that risked being worsened by the conflict in Ukraine. She also played down her visit to Russian President Vladimir Putin 5 years ago. To advance her position, Marine Le Pen put forward her own personal narrative of suffering. 5 years ago, her supporters had been horrified when she performed so badly in the 2017 presidential televised debate against Emmanuel Macron, mixing up names of companies, getting dossiers wrong, that it was described as political death live on air. She was written off as finished. But she believed that voters would identify with a personal story of picking herself up after defeat. People who have lived through painful moments can better understand the suffering and distress of others, she said. She talked about her difficult childhood as the child of a demonized political figure, Jean-Marie Le Pen, like her, a far-right presidential candidate, describing how, aged 8, she woke in her nightdress amid shards of glass and a blown-away bedroom wall following a bomb attack aimed at killing her father, Jean-Marie Le Pen. She talked about her teenage embarrassment at her parents' public divorce battle. The Gilets Jaunes protests had highlighted the difficulties of single mothers. Marine Le Pen described raising her own children alone. When her niece, Marion Marshall, abandoned Le Pen and joined rival Zemmour, Le Pen was emotional on television, saying she had helped raise Marion as a baby. But Marine Le Pen rose in the polls, while Eric Zemmour dropped. Ultimately, Le Pen knew that to have any chance of winning the final round of election, she must neutralize the nation's fear of her. Supporters of traditional political parties on the left and right had in the past voted tactically to keep her out because she was seen as dangerous, divisive, and unable to govern the country or run France's economy. But Marine Le Pen reasoned that those parties, the Socialists and Les Républicains, were shrinking on the national stage. By focusing on fears over the cost of living, Marine Le Pen began to turn public opinion around. In September of 2021, Le Pen was the 11th most popular political figure in France, already a high position. This month, she rose to become the nation's second favourite political personality, behind the former Prime Minister, Edouard Philippe. Last week, the pollster Brice Tinturier of Ipsos Poll found that if Le Pen were elected president tomorrow, more people expected an improvement in their own situation and the situation of the country than if Emmanuel Macron were re-elected. Just as many people trusted Le Pen to fix cost of living crisis as trusted Emmanuel Macron. An Odoxa poll for Loebs found that in a second-round vote, 19% of the French people would vote to stop Emmanuel Macron, more than the 18% who would vote to stop Marine Le Pen. The think tank, Fondation Jean Jaurès, last year set out the factors that could facilitate a Le Pen win. She would need to win over large numbers of voters from the traditional right. She would need to have normalised her image to the point the voters no longer found her so dangerous that they voted tactically to keep her out. Emmanuel Macron would have to be viewed with the same general level of mistrust as Marine Le Pen herself to make voters refuse to vote for him. Macron's tactic so far has been to remind voters of the details of Le Pen's manifesto, slamming it as racist, anti-Muslim platform that would wreck the economy and create mass unemployment in France. But Emmanuel Macron's camp has found it harder to make criticism stick to Marine Le Pen. Le Pen argues that catastrophizing against her no longer works. She said French people no longer see her as the big bad wolf. Meanwhile, President Emmanuel Macron has urged people to vote in Sunday's 24th of April's presidential election, in order to prevent a Trump-like upset that would hand victory to rival Marine Le Pen. Emmanuel Macron made the remark on Friday, 22nd of April, in the medieval village of Figeac, as the presidential campaign drew to a close. He also compared a potential Le Pen victory to the UK voting to leave the European Union. Think about what the British citizens were saying just a few hours before Brexit, or people in the United States just before Donald Trump's election happened. I'm not going to vote. What's the point? The next day, they woke up with a hangover, Emmanuel Macron said. So if you want to avoid the unthinkable, choose for yourself, the French president added. Analysis from the Financial Times shows Emmanuel Macron with 55.3% support compared to Marine Le Pen's 44.7%. However, Emmanuel Macron warned on Friday, 22nd of April, that opinion polls had not been able to predict former US President Donald Trump's election victory or even Brexit in Britain. Marine Le Pen also urged her supporters to come out and vote during her final campaign stop in Pas-de-Calais. Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen also clashed in a television debate on Wednesday, 20th of April, as the French President Emmanuel Macron claimed there could be civil war in France if Marine Le Pen implemented a plan to ban Muslim women from wearing headscarves.
Tensions continue to simmer in the occupied Al-Quds. Israeli forces have once again attacked Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Dozens of Palestinians have been injured. Why is the international community not giving this the attention that it deserves? Is it too preoccupied or distracted with Ukraine? In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at how Israeli desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and its violations against Palestinians has become a world rallying point behind Palestinians. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Founder of ThePolemist.net, Jim Kavanaugh, joins us from New York. We also have writer and activist Laith Maarouf, who joins us from Montreal. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, Jim Kavanaugh. We're looking at, in as many days, how the Israeli mosque, I'm sorry, the Al-Aqsa Mosque is being desecrated, and you have violence that's being exerted against the Palestinians. The Israeli police have used heavy-handed tactics against the Palestinian worshippers who want to pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, but they're being prevented from praying. Why has Israel decided to exercise such violations, which is, if you can say, more severe than previous times?
Yeah, I do think that Israel is taking advantage of the distraction of the world regarding Ukraine to be extremely militant in all kinds of ways. It's certainly at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, but also in the West Bank, Israeli settlers are destroying farmers' olive trees. Israel has just attacked Gaza again. I think Israel knows that the world's attention is even less than it normally is, going to be held on to going to be looking at Israel and being ready to criticize anything that Israel does. Everybody, certainly in the American sphere of influence, is all gung-ho now about Ukraine, and they're not going to let anything dilute that message. And Israel is going to have more impunity, it feels, I think, going after the Palestinians at this time. And I expect to see more of this. You know, I think they are taking advantage of the situation in the world and using it as a distraction behind which to really crack down in a nasty way against the Palestinians.
Well, Laith Maarouf, we need to make sure that this is highlighted, and that is the way that the news is being reported. I explained what has happened by saying Israeli police have used heavy-handed tactics against the Palestinian worshippers who wanted to pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Now, the media is reporting it as Israeli police clashed with Palestinian protesters on Friday in the latest violence at Jerusalem's Flashpoint Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. So it makes it look like, you know, it's the worshippers who also are exercising violence against the Israeli security forces. How do you see the media narrative that Israel is trying to paint? Is it successful?
I just want to caution, because last year, before the war started in Gaza, there was almost 2 weeks of constant humiliation and attacks and desecration of the Aqsa Mosque. And during those almost 2 weeks prior to the beginning of military activities from Gaza, the media in the West also ignored what was happening in Palestine last year. And therefore, I don't think at this moment we can say that there's that the Zionists are benefiting from the situation in Ukraine in terms of trying to hide their activities in Palestine. In fact, the media last year during the war, also the Western media, attempted to hide this reality from the viewers in the West, and it was the success of the Palestinian people and the diaspora of the Palestinian people and those who were in solidarity with them who flooded the social media with information about what was happening and broke the wall of silence in the West. Today, we're in the same situation. And, you know, there will be continued blackout of information from Palestine in the media in the West until the Palestinians and those who are in solidarity with them are able to break that blackout.
Well, taking a look at Jim Kavanaugh, the numbers coming through on how many have been injured. This is what the Palestinian Red Crescent has reported, that 57 people were wounded, including 14 Palestinians taken to the hospital, at least one of them in a serious condition. And this comes after the storming of the compound. They were all Palestinians. Why is it that not one Israeli was reported to have been injured? Why is there such an imbalance?
Well, for the same reason there's always an imbalance. Israel is armed. These are armed militants, whether they're armed police or armed army or armed settlers. And the Palestinians are an unarmed subject population. So they're the ones who are going to suffer from this. This is what's been going on for decades. And it's not going to stop. Now, I do hope there is the other side of the coin about the Ukraine situation is that all the arguments being made, there's no argument that's being made about Ukraine that can't be made about Israel, and you know, which has been going on for a lot longer and caused a lot more human suffering. So that is a way in which the discourse may be turned to Palestinians' benefit. But the imbalance of power, both militarily and on the ground in terms of police and army and armed settlers, and ideologically in the world in terms of the ideological apparatus of the world, which favors Israel. So, you know, we still are in that position, and it does require a tide of, it's a good way of putting it, a tide of discourse in social media to insist that the world pay attention to what's going on and what's happening to the Palestinians, which is, of course, a crime of 70 years.
Leith Maruf, what do you think about the heavy-handed tactics that have been used? I mean, we're looking at, first of all, Israel has called what it's doing, the tactic, it calls it a law and order approach in order to deal with the Palestinians. I'm looking at rubber-tipped bullets, and for the first time, the use of these drones to spray tear gas. And in one particular incident, this happened last week, however, a 17-year-old to have been shot in the abdomen with an exploding bullet that ruptured his blood vessels and veins. So I don't quite understand this law and order tactic that Israel says. Where is the law and where is the order?
Yeah, it doesn't matter what the Israelis say. What matters is that they are continuing to act insane. And, you know, to be very clear, everything that the Zionists are doing right now is actually harming their own objectives. If they were smart enough, as their master in D.C. is withdrawing from West Asia and attempting to concentrate on Russia and China, they would have calmed the situation for their master in West Asia and let things go smoothly until that situation with Russia is resolved somehow to the favor of their master. But they are, like, so insane in their supremacy that they can't hold themselves back and are, acting in such ways in Jerusalem that could lead us into a new war just like last year. And this time, things could spill out into a regional confrontation. And believe me, the United States is not ready for it, and definitely the Zionists are not ready for it.
Do you agree with that, Jim Kavanaugh, that this is going to potentially result in a wider, perhaps, war?
Yes, I think that's a real possibility. Look, they've attacked Gaza. I think that they do, as your other guest says, have a sense of superiority and omnipotence that's going to bite them in the butt if they keep up with it, you know, because at some point there's going to be a serious pushback and a serious fight back and a serious military fight back that threatens to lead to a wider war. You know, we're in a very dangerous situation in the world in general, and the Israelis are not, as the other guest says, they're not a faction that's, you know, going to be very shrewd about holding back. For if they see an opportunity, what they think is an opportunity to push forward and to gain some more territory and to repress the Palestinians some more, they will do it. And it's, at some point, that could lead very, very quickly to a regional war.
Well, Laith Maruf, we're looking at how Israel reinforced its so-called Iron Dome system on the Gaza border just recently. And some are looking at the way that Israel has reacted so far as pointing to the fact that perhaps the Prime Minister Naftali Bennett is really not too keen to go into a war with the Gaza Strip because, A, it doesn't want to see what happened last time around when there was a war, because obviously the Iron Dome, in one respect and one aspect of that war, did not function the way that it should have. And B, it doesn't want to see the occupied West Bank erupt in protests. How do you assess it?
Well, it's clear from the last few days of attacks on Gaza that the resistance has new capabilities, and they've hinted to them with what we saw of the use of anti-air missiles that chased away the F-16s and the Apache helicopters of the Zionists. And therefore, it's clear in any next confrontation, we will see new weapons come into play. The other very important signal that came out in the last few days was from the Islamic Republic of Iran, where it showed its latest and most advanced drone named Gaza. And this drone can carry half a ton of explosives and can fly for over 36 hours before refueling. And therefore, this is Iran giving a signal to the Zionists not to push the envelope. We know from the last confrontation that there was at least 8 drones flying over the occupied territories by Hezbollah and the Axis of Resistance. So the hints that were given out in the last few days by the Axis of Resistance from Palestine all the way to the Islamic Republic is clearly signaling that we are ready for defending Jerusalem.
Same question to you, Jim Kavanaugh. Of course, the way that the resistance has accelerated and improved the tools that it has to use in its resistance operations is now more advanced. The last war proved just that. And we can see how Israel is scrambling to improve the Iron Dome capabilities. At the same time, many are saying that Israel is not keen on having this war. And according to the way, for example, how Hamas has reacted, it has said that international mediators have continued contacting them, but they could only hold back so much because if the violations continue, this is going to set off another military confrontation. Do you foresee that happening?
Well, you know, I can't predict exactly what's going to happen, but I say there's a real danger of it. And yes, the Israelis know and the Americans know that the Axis of Resistance has weapons, has new weapons. That's what the Iran nuclear negotiations are really about. They're about trying to stop Iran from supporting the Axis of Resistance, and the Axis of Resistance getting weapons and getting technologies that will threaten Israeli cities. So you know, there are factions in the United States and Israel who want war, and there are factions who are afraid of war. And this is one of the things that, you know, we can't control. They're going to have their debates and discussions, and it's hard to know who's in the ascendancy in that. But there definitely is a situation that everyone in the world should be aware of, that these things are not any longer going to go down just one way. The damage isn't just going to be done to Israel, to Palestine and Gaza. You know, there's a real threat of damage to Israel, and there's a real threat of Hamas saying, you've crossed a red line of Al-Aqsa or whatever it is, and Iran saying, you've crossed a red line, and this becoming a wider war. So, you know, this is something that everyone in the world should be aware of. And unfortunately, Western media isn't making people aware of it.
Well, there's another major development that's happening, Laith Maruf. Of course, this started years and years ago, but we're seeing it accelerated in the past weeks, especially the past days, because of people seeing the side of Israeli police officers deploying and firing, for example, these stun grenades to inside the mosque or at Palestinians, and the heavy-handed tactics that they used. And that is what's happened on social media, which is translated now to protests that are happening worldwide. We're seeing lots of organizations that have come out in support of Palestinians. Looking at, for example, in Berlin, in Germany, or even New York, there was one days ago, and other parts of the world. Do you think that this is going to snowball into the media attention that this deserves, and then, of course, the plight of Palestinians?
Yes, of course. I mean, this is now a predictable pattern. In fact, I just want to be very, very clear to our listeners, viewers in the East and the South, that the vast majority of labor unions and student unions and civil society organizations in much of Canada, much of the United States and Western Europe have already signed on to the boycott, divestment, and sanctions years ago. Some of the organizations, for instance, here in Quebec, the largest unions signed on to the BDS over a decade ago. So what are the maximum that these demonstrations and civil society movements can do in a country like Canada or the West? Is already been shown. The governments in the West do not care for the opinion of their civilians. They don't even care about the opinions of Canadians who don't want, for instance, the genocide of Indigenous people in Canada, but the Canadian government continues. So why would they stop supporting genocide in Palestine because the Canadian public, for instance, doesn't like that? So the truth of the matter is that, yes, we will need to continue this work of informing people in the West, but just as understanding that is part of a propaganda war and an effort to lift the spirits of our people on the ground in Palestine. Beyond that, there is no hope of changing the position of Western governments except through the military defeat of their Zionist colony, their beachhead war island that is there to destabilize West Asia and North Africa.
A number of reports have come out in the past, not this year, but overall in about a year's time, that we're looking at Jim Kavanaugh, that have labeled Israel as an apartheid regime. One of the most recent ones has come out by Michael Link, the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip, which he has said Israel's decade-long occupation, quote, has become indistinguishable from practices of apartheid and based on institutional discrimination of one racial, national, ethnic group over another. Nothing new there, but it keeps being highlighted now at a more accelerated pace. Do you think that has led to the world really realizing what is going on and therefore leading to mass mobilizations, as we have seen recently?
Well, it's a sign, you know, over the past 18 months, certainly 2 years, the notion of calling Israel an apartheid state has become much more prevalent. You know, I wrote about it, you know, my good friend Richard Falk has been doing it for decades, and now it's become the Human Rights Watch itself, Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem. Essentially, this is a regime of ethnic supremacy from the river to the sea, you know, and this is now widely accepted in the Western discourse in a way that it wasn't, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. But still, we have to recognize that hasn't resulted in a political breakthrough. You know, as your previous guest says, the political and the major media, establishment media outlets are kind of immune to the pressure to a great extent. And really, they're not going to get worried about it until Israel starts to be threatened in a way that they can see militarily. I think that's correct. In a way that they see that, you know, this is a real danger. And then they'll start to take it more seriously. So Israel has already lost the ideological war. Zionism has lost the ideological war among people around the world. Even it's losing it among young Jewish people in the United States. And that's a fact. But that the political implications of that and the breakthrough implications in terms of what would happen to change radically the situation in Palestine has not broken through to the political controlling elements of politics and media in the Western world.
Is there even a political incentive for Israel, Leith Maruf, to? I mean, I know that this particular administration, headed by Naftali Bennett, has said we're not interested in any type of discussions, and they've gone ahead with their. Not that previous administrations were. I mean, they say they were, but the settlement buildings continued, the violations continued. But this particular one has said no talks. Why do you think that is?
There's a very famous video.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
There's a very famous video of current President Biden from the 90s speaking to an audience, telling them that the United States, if there was no Israel, would have invented Israel. And this is what people need to understand, that the Israelis know this. That the actual empire, the existence currently, to be able to rule the world from D.C., to be able to project its military hegemony and its cultural hegemony over much of Asia and Africa, it has no choice but to maintain the Zionist colony. The minute the Zionist colony ceases to exist, then all the order that it controls, the United States controls in Western Asia and North Africa, will collapse, and therefore the United States will not be able to project its power to the rest of Asia and Africa. And this is what, you know, continuing to speak about the Zionist lobby as something that is forcing the United States to do something that it doesn't want to is actually harmful. The Zionists themselves know that the existence of the United States as an empire depends on them, and the empire knows that too. And therefore, their existence is in a symbiosis. And now that when you understand that, then it's easier to identify our enemy and the steps to take to defeat that enemy.
I wish I had time for one more question for you, Jim Cavanaugh. We're fresh out of time. I do apologize for that. Let me thank your guest, writer and activist Leith Maruf, who spoke to us from Montreal. Thank you, Leith Maruf, and thank you, Jim Cavanaugh.